Prohibition was based on the idea that consuming alcohol was immoral and directly opposed to Christian values. But for Jews living in America during the late 19th and early 20th centuries, it was hard to accept this Christian justification for a law that stood in direct opposition to not only some of their religious practices, but also their economic stability. In her new book, Jews and Booze, Becoming American in the Age of Prohibition, Marnie Davis, an assistant professor of history at Georgia State University, explains how Prohibition forced Jews to choose between their culture and assimilation into mainstream American society. It's published by New York University Press, and I'm pleased to welcome Marnie Davis to our show today. Hello.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So much has been written about the Jewish immigrant experience and about the Prohibition era. How did you come up with the idea of combining the two?
I came up with it when I was a graduate student. I was just in the stacks looking for a project idea, and I came upon a photograph that came out of a magazine article written about a race riot that had just taken place in Atlanta. And the caption to the photograph noted that the photographs were of two saloons, both of which were owned by people who had clearly Jewish names. Abelsky was one and Cohen was the other. And the caption to the photograph said, many of the saloons that catered to Negroes were run by immigrants, usually Jews. And so the first thing that I thought was, really, saloons? You know, when you think of Jewish entrepreneurial niches, they're usually the garment trade, the entertainment industry, and things like that. And I had just never thought about the alcohol industry in as part of that. And then the second question that I asked was, what did that bring some kind of alarm for people? Why mention Jews at all? And that started me on this project.
So was there an anti-Semitic sentiment in the Prohibition, the temperance movement, or an anti-immigrant sentiment?
There was certainly an anti-immigrant sentiment from the very beginning. I mean, even dating back to the earlier temperance movement in the 19th century, there was a lot of concern about both Irish immigrants and German immigrants. And Jews weren't really part of that. And in the mainstream, sort of the Prohibition establishment organizations like the Women's Christian Temperance Union and the Anti-Saloon League, both organizations that were very wary of and hostile to immigrants sometimes, Jews didn't really come up. You see it on other figures, people like Henry Ford, members of the Ku Klux Klan. So it's hard to say fringe figures because Ford's not a fringe figure in 1920. He is central to the culture, but it's not part of the establishment. But it definitely is part of the larger conversation about who is causing the alcohol problem in America.
And were Ford and the KKK in support of Prohibition?
Oh, absolutely. Both of them were. Both of them thought that alcohol had contributed to the spiritual, moral downfall of the nation and also to its economic problems. They thought that especially Ford, he wanted to make sure that his workers weren't drinking so that they would be more productive.
But he also was anti-Semitic. He kept copies of Protocols of the Elders of Zion in his office and used to give them to visitors.
Right.
Were Jews uniquely affected by Prohibition as opposed to other immigrant groups?
I wouldn't say uniquely. They certainly had their own specific, unique experience, but many other immigrant groups also felt rage in response to Prohibition. I mean, Germans, certainly, in the years leading up to World War
One. I would imagine Italians and the French as well, because
sure.
They had traditions of having wine with their meals.
Yes, but there was something different about the Volstead Act, the national prohibition law that put the prohibition into effect. And this was Section 6 of the Volstead Act, which made sacramental wine available for the purposes of religious ritual. And this made wine available to both Catholics and Jews. But because of the way that Jews consume wine, which is in the home around the dinner table, it turned out that wine was sort of dissipating into the community and it became very easy to get.
Although Robert Mondavi told me that his family got into the wine business as suppliers to Italian immigrants of wine grapes during Prohibition.
Oh, sure. And George Latour in California, a French immigrant, also got involved in sacramental wine. But what happened because of Section 6 was that there was a sort of an interweaving of concerns about alcohol and concerns about the role that Jews played in the American economy. It sort of hit all of the alarm bells for some.
But for people who in the temperance movement, how was the story of Jesus turning water into wine explained?
Variously. Some earlier on, some had said, well, he did this, but if he had known about the real effects, if he had the scientific knowledge that we have today, he never would have done that. But others claimed that, in fact, what he had done was turn water into pure wine, which was unfermented grape juice. And prohibitionists, and especially prohibitionists who were motivated by Protestant theology, spent a lot of time in doing exegetical work, trying to figure out how it was exactly, or to explain how what Jesus was doing was not making fermented wine, but instead making unfermented wine. And Jews, of course, responded by saying that's utterly ridiculous.
Well, alcohol played two different roles within the Jewish community. On the one hand, as you pointed out, some were in the business of owning saloons and the like, small business people. Others were actually in the business of manufacturing it. And then there was a whole religious side of it, drinking wine during certain religious rituals. Within the Jewish community, Jews were also forbidden from consuming wine that was made or even handled by non-Jews.
Well, that's interesting. I mean, that is the strictest law regarding kosher wine, that kosher wine can only be produced by a Jew who keeps kosher from the moment of the picking of the grapes till the moment that it is poured into the chalice or the glass. There is actually a long tradition of that rule being broken or loopholes being sought for Jews who sought integration into their larger communities. And I mean, this dates back well before the American scene. It dates back even to, you know, the Eastern Europe, and you could even find evidence of it in the Middle East. But it's worth suggesting that Jews were, if Jews who were keeping kosher in other ways, not mixing milk and meat, were drinking wine in order to be convivial with their neighbors.
Well, Reform Judaism was growing in popularity in the late 19th century.
Yes, precisely.
Reform Jews, did they have different attitudes about wine than Orthodox Jews?
Well, I think that they had sort of multiple attitudes. Certainly Isaac Mayer Wise, who was probably the most important leader of the American Reform Jewish movement. He created most of the establishment institutions from his pulpit in Cincinnati in the late 19th century. And simultaneously encouraged American Jews to abandon some of the rules of kashrut, of keeping kosher, in order to become more acculturated in their American environment. At the same time, when a man named Benjamin Dreyfus, who established a general winery in Anaheim, California, started to make kosher wine, Wise celebrated that. And he said, this is good for the economics of our community, and it's also good for the spiritual connection to the history of the Jewish people. So they kind of had it both ways a little bit.
My guest is Marnie Davis, assistant professor of history at Georgia State University. Her book, Jews and Booze, Becoming American in the Age of Prohibition. But Rabbi Wise had another, he was involved in another dispute. The temperance movement was largely run by women, Women's Christian Temperance Union.
Indeed.
And you say that in 1893, a group called the National Council of Jewish Women was founded, largely because Jewish women, too, wanted the chance to participate in reform organizations like the WCTU. And then Rabbi Wise wrote in 1874, any Jewish lady would consider it sacrilege and blasphemy to abuse prayer and benediction for purpose of public demonstrations. There were no whiskey Amazons in the tents of Israel.
Yes, that's true.
Feminist, this rabbi.
Certainly not. And most Reform rabbis in the 19th century were not. They were sort of aghast at, not sort of aghast, they were absolutely aghast at the prospect of women, especially women praying in public, which is what happened during the Women's Christian Temperance Union was founded after the Women's Crusade in 1873 and 1874. And this was a movement of grassroots activism where these women would go into saloons and sit in front of saloons and pray until the saloon keeper promised to never sell another drop of alcohol. And Reform rabbis just found this utterly appalling and saw this as a transgression of the proper gendered behavior of women, and Jewish women, they said, would never do such a thing.
But it seems to me that we have two different things pulling at the Jewish community at this time. On the one hand, there's business and there's tradition, and on the other hand, there's the desire to assimilate and be like everybody else.
Precisely. They managed, in the 19th century, American Jews, and especially those Reform Jews who spoke out against prohibition, they found a way to make claims about their connection to alcohol, their attachments to alcohol, that laid claim to both. That said, we are Jewish. We have this longstanding connection to alcohol, both in terms of consuming it and also in terms of producing it and selling it. But the way that we produce it and the way that we consume it actually makes us better Americans because we consume it. They claimed that Jewish consumption of alcohol was sort of naturally moderate as opposed to saloon goers of other ethnic groups. It seems to me that that's not actually true, the claims that they were making, that it was much more complicated than that. But those are the claims they were making.
But was alcoholism less of a problem within the Jewish community?
Records suggest that it was. And, I mean, both public health records at the time and anecdotal evidence from people who I've talked to, there seems to be a general consensus that Jews drink less than do other people, members of other ethnic groups.
Maybe it's because kosher wines are so sweet. We have Rabbi Dov Ber Manashevitz making wines from indigenous American varietals like Concord grapes, the same stuff that we get grape jelly from.
Yes.
And it's very sweet.
Very sweet.
So they were less interested in doing something that would be like a Bordeaux or a Burgundy.
But yes, then that's true. But so few Americans drank wine in the 19th century. It really was a consumption habit of the elite. Americans drank beer and they drank whiskey, and they drank a lot of whiskey.
But you also point out that record numbers of Jewish-owned saloons also opened in the late 19th century. So Jews started to be seen as moral and economic threats to the American way of life?
Sure. And this wasn't only in regards to alcohol. There was a growing sense amongst native-born Americans, especially native-born American Protestants, that immigrants in general, but Jews in particular, were playing a nefarious role in the American economy, that especially, I mean, economic anti-Semitism certainly predates the American scene. There is a long-standing tradition that comes out of Europe that Jews are play a parasitic role in any economy that they participate in. And so that idea makes its way to the United States.
Well, why were so many Jews involved in various alcoholic pursuits? We have some of the great whiskey producers being Jewish families. Even today, the Bronfmans they're Canadian, but
yes.
Still.
Yeah, sure. There's, I think, a combination of reasons. Some of it is that there is this longstanding connection between Jews as a religious community and alcohol, in which there isn't any taboo against alcohol the way that there is in some denominations of Protestantism, for instance. Second, there is a tradition of participating in the alcohol industry in Europe, dating back to the Middle East, but certainly in Eastern Europe, Jews were known to be among the tavern keepers and the distillers and the brewers. And so they brought both that experience with them and also just the sense that that was an available opportunity for them. And third, there's just the issue of chain migration, that one person shows up in the industry, turns out to be one where there's fantastic opportunity. So he brings over his brother and his cousin. And then next thing you know, in cities like Louisville and Cincinnati, there are pretty vocal, large and visible communities of Jewish wholesalers of whiskey and so on.
You point out that because alcoholic beverages were available in synagogues at the end of the service, people with non-Jewish last names joined synagogues in large numbers in the 20s?
Yes. Though it's also worth pointing out that Jews were also beginning to join congregations in larger numbers. There is a record of one congregation in Oakland, California, that before Prohibition that had been about 50 families. And by 1921, this is 500 families were now members of this congregation, and nobody for a second thought that they were there because they had found their Jewish roots. They were there for the sacramental wine.
On the other hand, there were some Jewish organizations that urged Jews to use grape juice instead of wine at Passover.
Yes.
During the Prohibition years. And some of the most famous Prohibition agents like Izzy Einstein and Moe Smith were busting the bootleggers.
They were, and flamboyantly, enthusiastically so. I mean, Izzy Einstein was one of the famous and self-promoting, sort of happily self-promoting of the Prohibition agents to such a degree that he ended up getting fired for it. But he was a character, I guess you would say, and he used that character, that he used his resemblance to sort of a Jewish character, a Jewish, stereotypically Jewish character, to his advantage. And Americans were delighted to read about it.
On the other hand, there were Jewish gangsters like Meyer Lansky who made alliances with mobsters like Lucky Luciano.
Sure.
To bring booze into America during right. Prohibition.
So Jews were absolutely on all sides. I mean, much like other Americans, Jews were on all sides of this argument. There were Jews who participated in its illegal purveyance, much like others did. There were Jews who fought fought to make it less available, much like other Jews did, much like other Americans did. So it's really the conflict, the tensions between Jews within the Jewish community in the United States over Prohibition. There are some things about it that are unique to the Jewish experience, but in other ways it shows just how American Jews had become.
Well, you're right. The Jews stayed in place on the issue while American culture changed around them, and they eventually found themselves not only on the losing side of the national debate, but also distrusted, even vilified, for ever having been on the side of liquor. Did that distrust have lasting consequences after repeal?
Certainly, the 1930s were a period of heightened anti-Semitism in America.
Well, there was also the emergence of Hitler in Germany.
Right, and a movement of allied fascists and anti-Semites in the United States. But also there was a growth of social anti-Semitism in America, where Jews were kept out of country clubs and away from participating in at colleges, from enrolling in particular colleges. So all of that was happening simultaneously. But it seemed to me that one of the things that happened, although anti-Semitism was on the rise in the 1930s, that Prohibition, the end of Prohibition, the failure, the massive, unequivocal failure of Prohibition to do away with the problems of that alcohol had caused, really makes alcohol less of an issue of anxiety in America. And so though anti-Semitism goes away, this image of the nefarious Jewish alcohol entrepreneur does dissipate in American culture because alcohol is no longer seen as the problem that it once was.
Marnie Davis is assistant professor of history at Georgia State University. Her book, Jews and Booze, Becoming American in the Age of Prohibition, is published by NYU Press. And I want to thank you so much for being on our show today to talk about this little-known aspect of American history.
I'm really glad to be here. Thanks.